Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast, where we celebrate cinema from the highfalutin to the mindfalutin. It was a new slogan suggested by a listener of ours. Thank you very much.
That's a fun one.
And you no longer have to mix in that the sound effect.
One more?
Okay, one more. There it is. It's not a show until we get a sound effect. My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a film critic of some stripe and no renown. I don't have a cool nickname, but who does have a cool nickname but my scintillating co-host?
I don't think it's a cool nickname. I think it's just a nickname.
Well, you do have all nicknames are cool.
It's not
as far as I'm concerned.
It's not like, you know,
Crash Harrington or something.
Yeah, you know? Like Nitro or whatever. Anyway, my name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs. We've got a lot of reviews for you this week. We're going to be talking about the winners of the 93rd Annual Academy Awards. We are going to be reviewing the new releases. I had it written down somewhere. Mortal Kombat, Together Together, Sisters with Transistors, Hope, Monday, Honeydew, and Jacob's Wife. We're playing a little catch-up because this last week was a nightmare for us scheduling-wise, and then I got my second vaccine, and I just became kind of zombie.
Yeah, knocked you out a night, so that's a night we can't record.
Yeah, it was a rough week. We know some people noticed we had fewer podcasts than usual. We're sorry about that. We're trying not to let that happen again. Also, on the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club, we're going to be playing a little catch-up, too, because we got two movies to review. From last week, we have Steven Spielberg's rarely discussed sort of bureaucracy comedy, The Terminal. And then we have the 1970s killer car movie, The Car. And I actually think they have some similarities.
I can't wait to hear. I've always been a big advocate of programming as criticism. I'm on record with this. So I've always felt that if you put two films together, no matter what they are, your mind will like reach for connections. I've tested this and proved it wrong a couple times. There's no connection between Spice World and The Last Emperor. Not that I could see.
British colonialism?
Yeah, I was about to say, like, that's about as far as you can go.
Is Peter Spice World Spice
isn't
World?
Spice World isn't about colonialism. It's just a British film.
No, but the Spice Girls colonized popular music.
Oh, of course.
But then... sometimes they're thin. Sometimes they're thin. But every once in a while, you get something really fascinating.
The Spice World and the Forbidden City are pretty much the same, right?
There you go. In any case, so we're going to be bringing all those movies, and we want to jump right into the Academy Awards. Ordinarily, Whitney and I treat the Academy Awards kind of like a little sport, or at least a little gambling wager, where we try to compete to see who can guess the most Academy Awards winners every year. Sometimes we've done wagers, and this year, we just... weren't feeling it.
Well, it was an odd year because of the release schedule, because they pushed the Oscars back and expanded the window for when films were eligible.
Totally Everything understandable was, in yeah. that case, by the way. I
of
totally
course,
get that. Yeah,
all of the traditional beats and rhythms of the year were completely thrown off. So it was difficult to figure out what had buzz, what was going to be nominated. And once it was nominated, even though I had seen more films in 2020 than I think I had in any other year, that is new films, I was still behind.
Yeah, same here.
And I tried to catch up real hard.
You did a good job.
And I saw every single film that was nominated for an Academy Award except for three.
Which three?
Better Days, which is up for Best International Feature, and then two of the documentaries. I didn't see Time, and I didn't see My Octopus Teacher, which ended up winning.
You're way ahead of
but
me.
But I saw all the other films.
You're
like,
way
literally
way
all the other films. I was very proud of myself.
I usually
which
try
is
to
not even as good as my wife, who did see them all.
Wow,
she was able to catch them.
I usually try to see them all. I'm usually pretty good. This year, things were just really rough, and I actually was a little embarrassed by how few films I had seen. I actually haven't seen, I'm actually not going to tell you which ones, but I haven't seen all of the Best Picture nominees. Okay, fine. I didn't see The Father. All right? I didn't see The Father, and I didn't see Judas and the Black Messiah, and I regret that. Literally, the day I went to see Judas and the Black Messiah on HBO Max was the day they took it off HBO Max.
No!
And I'm like, no, I can't afford to see it. Okay. So there's a couple of big ones that I'm behind on, but I did see most of the films that ended up winning. And I didn't see the actual awards ceremony. I know you said you did.
I did. I watched the telecast.
It was directed by Steven Soderbergh this year, who apparently brought a different vibe.
It was a lot more laid back. They filmed it at Union Station rather than in a theater. So they just had It was just the nominees in the, and not even all the nominees, because some were living in other countries.
Yeah.
But all of the nominees who were able to make it to Los Angeles, they put in this sort of makeshift theater with tables.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they even got food. It was a little bit more like the Golden Globes in that respect.
Well, the original Academy Awards was that small a party.
Yeah.
It was not a big televised event, because TV didn't exist.
So. And I like that because it took out the theatrical element, which meant there weren't a lot of the showier aspects of the night. It was a little bit more stripped down.
I always thought it was ironic that the Academy Awards typically celebrate the art form of cinema through the art form of live theater.
Yeah, it's a little bizarre.
I got nothing against live theater, but it's kind of like, hey, it's the Grammys, and we're going to celebrate all of the Grammy-nominated songs with short films. And I'm like, what?
And we're not going to play the music in those short films.
Yeah, weird choices.
I do miss the host. It was another hostless year, and I miss the idea of a host. But, c'est la vie.
Anyway.
And they were steaming through. They jumbled up the order of the awards, which is a little weird. They didn't announce Best Picture last, which was really weird.
Let's just talk about the elephant in the room here. They announced Best Picture, and then they announced Best Lead Actress, and then Best Lead Actor. And the obvious idea here, and that no one to the best of my knowledge has explicitly said that this was the plan, but I think the obvious idea here was Chadwick Boseman, who has sadly passed away last year, was considered the front runner for Best Actor. So I think what the Academy Awards producers wanted to do really was end on a high note.
They really thought Chadwick Boseman was going to win.
Yeah, and that was going to be this big, important, memorable moment.
We're going to put it at the very end. We're going to get out. And usually it's the previous year's actress announces actor and vice versa. And they got actress to do actress this year, and so Joaquin Phoenix was going to read Best Actor.
Okay, which is odd, kind of arbitrary, but whatever. Joaquin Phoenix announced Best Actor, and the winner was Anthony Hopkins from The Father, who wasn't even there and didn't, like, record a little segment. So that was just it.
He's 83. He's in England. He's asleep.
He doesn't have to do a damn thing. I'm not complaining about Anthony Hopkins. He didn't do anything wrong, but, like... What, again, if you ever needed proof that, like, the producers don't know who won these things, I think that's it. Because if they had known that, there is absolutely no way they would have not ended with Nomadland winning Best Picture, which is a big deal. Chloe Zhao became only the second woman to win the Academy Award for Best Director and the first woman of color to do so.
Yeah, and only the fourth time an Asian person has won Best Director.
And two times it was Ang Lee.
Yeah, two of those were Ang Lee.
Yeah, for films that didn't win Best Picture, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, Life of Pi and Brokeback Mountain, he won Director for.
Both got snubbed. Annoying.
Brokeback Mountain just totally should have won.
Oh my god, especially Brokeback. My god, really. Over Crash beat it.
Yeah, Crash beat Brokeback Mountain. The other one was Bong Joon-ho just last year, and now Chloe Zhao. So, and
good for her. Listen, that wasn't my favorite movie of the year, but it's very well directed. She's amazing. Good for her.
I really love Nomadland. I will not begrudge it any of its wins.
Neither will I.
I filled out one of those ballots just to see how many I could get right. I did abysmally badly. I got 11 categories correct, which I think is the worst I've ever done.
How do you feel about Frances McDormand winning? First off, I do not mind Frances McDormand winning 3 Academy Awards.
Mm.
I think she's the first, like, actress to do so since Katharine Hepburn. Meryl Streep. Sorry, because she...
Well, Meryl Streep also won supporting. I think she's the first to win lead actress 3 times.
No, Katharine Hepburn won lead actress 3 times.
I mean, since Katharine
Hepburn. Oh, yeah. But yes, and good for her. She's one of the best actresses working. But, you know, again, you save both best actress and best actor for last, and these were both categories in which the front runner was Viola Davis or Chadwick Boseman. And then it's both, you know, white actors who've won before. And it's just a bad... way to end the ceremony.
It seemed a little anticlimactic. Yeah. But you know what?
And arguably disrespectful. So what are you going
to
do?
Anticlimax. There's always something to complain about at the Oscars every year.
Oh, yeah.
It's never been, wow, that was a great show. Let's just talk about how perfectly it went. Never. That's never, ever the conversation.
Even the ones people liked, other people hate.
So you watch the telecast and you're waiting for the fuck-ups. That's all you want. You're kind of waiting for. And... okay, they did a little awkwardly this year.
Yeah.
Fine. It was a weird year. It was 2020. Mm. This is the last gasp of 2020.
Yeah.
Gotta
have one last monster.
Kind of exhalation of the year.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the other winners here. Daniel Kaluuya won Best Supporting Actor for Judas and the Black Messiah. As I have already confessed, I haven't seen that one yet. I will.
He's great, his acceptance speech was really great.
I heard that, yeah.
He thanked his parents for having sex.
I haven't heard an actor do that since Adam Sandler won an MTV Movie Award.
Wow.
Yeah. Let's see what we got here. Yunya Jung won for Best Supporting Actress for Minari.
I'm glad for that, too.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That made me happy.
Best Original Screenplay went to Emerald Fennell for Promising Young Woman, a movie both you and I have admired. Some people take a serious issue with the movie's ending. And I get it. I have a different take on that, but I can't really explain why without going into spoilers.
Yeah.
However, I do think it's a very bold film, and I highly recommend it.
I did read some of the dissenting opinions, and there are some excellent points being made in the world of criticism about Promising Young Woman.
Yeah.
And how it
pro and con.
I still love the film. I still really admire it, but I do understand the ambivalence toward it.
There's a lot of people I know, myself included, who thought it was incredibly strong, but there's a lot of people who really didn't respond well to it for reasons that range from totally awesome and excellent and I totally believe you to I disagree with your interpretation of the ending, like that kind of thing. But like, whatever. It's exciting that there's a film that is interesting enough to debate.
Yeah.
Won the award, at least. Let's see what we got here. Best Adapted Screenplay was The Father. Which I didn't see either. Best Animated Feature went to Pixar, because of course it did.
And Pixar also won Best Score.
That one I'm less mad about. Soul did have a really good score.
It did have a really good score, yeah. And I'm not going to begrudge how great the score is, but there's this idea going around that Pixar made a film specifically about jazz, that Soul is a movie about jazz.
Yeah.
But if you recall the story of Soul, it's more about pizza than it's about jazz.
Well, not specifically pizza.
Not specifically pizza, but it's about
the reasons why we value life.
Yeah, yeah.
Life itself, and that can be big things and small things.
And the big arc is about this this very old soul that has, for many millennia, not find a purpose to live, and finally finds it in... like essentially just eating.
True, but I do think it's disingenuous to suggest that jazz isn't a major centerpiece, because for the protagonist, that was the reason to live. So I think it's fair to fair to point it out.
It's still in there. Yeah. Yes.
Let's see. Best International Feature went to Another Round.
A fair one. Did you see Another Round?
I didn't see that one. No.
It's about alcoholism, but it's a comedy.
I know you missed Better Days, but of the four Best International Feature nominees you saw, Another Round, Collective, The Man Who Sold His Skin, and Quo Vadis Aida, what would you have voted for?
Collective.
Yeah?
Collective was great.
Awesome.
Yeah. All right. If you want to be furious at the way bureaucracy is slowly murdering society, then see Collective.
Let's see. Best Documentary Feature, as you said, went to My Octopus Teacher with Neither of Us Saw. A lot of people really mad about that one.
It was the only one that was kind of lightweight. I guess The Mole Agent was also kind of sweet.
But it was topical.
It was topical, yeah. It had a point to it.
Let's see what we got here. Best Documentary Short Subject went to Colette. And if you want to hear us talk about all of the Oscar-nominated short films, all 15 of them, check out Critically Acclaimed from like 2 weeks ago, maybe three.
Yeah, we put out a special episode.
Yeah, so if you want to hear about all of those, and I highly recommend you do because they're interesting films. Colette was a film about a woman whose brother was part of the French Resistance. She was too, but he was taken as a POW to a camp and died in World War II. And Colette won. It's a very, very good short. It's very sweet. It's very touching. Not what I would have voted for, but it's hard to begrudge it. I think Do Not Split had some just incredibly immediate, and A Love Song for Latasha was just absolutely heartbreaking. But Best Live Action Short Film went to the high concept time loop movie Two Distant Strangers,
which was a little unexpected. I thought it was going to go to
either Feeling Through, which is a very sentimental film, or possibly The Letter Room, because it feels the most like a feature film, and the Academy loves that.
I thought it was going to be that one.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be one of those too. But Distant Strangers is a good film. Let's see, animated short film, If Anything Happens, I Love You, which rubbed both of us the wrong way.
Neither of us responded well to that, but it got a lot of praise.
People loved it.
A lot of critics really, really, really loved it, even though it's mawkish, emotional cheap shots.
I'm not a fan. Again, I'm sure the intention was genuine, but the way that they handled it, I thought was just bad.
Bad.
Let's see, again, you can hear us talk about that in a lot of detail in the other podcast. We're not going to spend too much time on original score. We already covered. Best original song went to Judas and the Black Messiah. I've heard this song, and it's very good.
Song is quite good.
Yeah, I dig it. I dig it. Part of me was really pulling for Eurovision. It's not the song I would have nominated from Eurovision, because I think it's Ya Ya Ding Dong is the one. Yeah. I think if Ya Ya Ding Dong had been nominated, it would have won. I think we can all agree on this, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
It's... I really wish the silly songs...
Just once in a while.
Would get in there.
Like when the...
You suggested when the first Captain America film came out.
Oh, yeah, the Star-Spangled Man.
Star-Spangled Man was like That's this a great kind song. Of like... I think it's an Alan Menken song, too. It's like this kind of like jaunty little ad about how great it is to fight for the red, white, and blue. And it's sung by Captain America.
Yeah, it would have been a great production number on the stage and everything like that. It's memorable. I really thought that was a good one. I was bummed when Everything Is Awesome didn't win. I think a lot of people really liked that one a lot. The fun songs are often fun, and maybe we should celebrate them once in a while. I'm not saying all the time, but anyway. Best sound, this is the first year that they, in many years, that they combined the two sound categories. It used to be best sound.
Sound editing and sound mixing.
Yeah, sound editing and sound mixing, and those are two different disciplines, but they decided to share the award. And apparently those two like branches were cool with that. I guess they voted for it. But sound went to Sound of Metal. The Academy, like, is really, like, last, like, 10, 15 years, is less inclined to pick an action movie here than most people would assume.
Hmm.
I think a lot of people assume it's going to go to something with a lot of, like, bullets.
Like, Greyhound was up for sound.
Yeah, exactly. And great sound in that movie. I like Greyhound a lot, but, like, Sound of Metal used it to tell a story.
I'm actually really surprised Greyhound wasn't up for more awards, just in terms of its prestige, its pedigree.
It doesn't have a big emotional hook. I think that's the end. I think the Academy likes a big emotional hook.
All right.
Anyway, it's a good movie though. I like it. Production design went to Mank, which fine, whatever. It's not production design is good. I'm not going to fight that. Best cinematography went to Mank, which
it's actually not great cinematography.
I don't think it's great cinematography. I think it's really like showy cinematography in a way that's like not actually evocative of the era, which is. I guess fine, but if I wish it didn't imply that it was evocative of the era, which I think is a misstep. I think I probably I haven't seen News of the World. I haven't seen a lot of those. I actually have Don't Have a Right to Judge from Best Cinematography.
Okay.
I mean, if I've missed like one, I might tell you what I think I would have voted for. But no, I've missed a couple of those. So, but I Nomadland would have been very deserving. Best makeup and hairstyling ended up going to Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which is a good choice.
Mm.
A lot of good nominees in that category. You saw Pinocchio, and most people didn't.
I did. Just in a quest to try to see all of these nominees.
Yeah, a lot of people were surprised that movie existed, and we just heard about it tonight. There was an
Italian, a new Italian production of Pinocchio with Roberto Benigni, but completely separate from the other Pinocchio with Roberto Benigni.
This time he plays Geppetto, which fine.
And the other one he played Pinocchio, and he directed that film.
That's a bad movie. Amazing like production and costume design on it. Like it's a good looking film, but like the movie's terrible.
If you want something that feels a little bit more like grungy, Terry Gilliam, like Baron Munchausen kind of look to it, where everything's really kind of busy and the creatures are all really impressive. There's a lot of animal people in the Pinocchio story. And they just put people in this really elaborate makeup. It's not CG. And it's some really impressive creature makeup. There's rabbit people. There's an 8-foot snail woman. It's all...
Is it good?
It's great.
The movie, I mean.
Oh, the movie, it's very peculiar.
Okay.
It's not going to have, like, a big punch to it, but yeah, it's quite enjoyable. If you're a Tim Burton or Terry Gilliam fan going back, you'll like it.
Best costume design went to Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which I'm totally okay with, but I am a little surprised by because it takes place over one day, and usually they like to celebrate, like, a lot of costumes, so I thought it was going to go to something like Emma or Mulan or something.
Should have gone to Emma, really.
Yeah, probably. Let's see what we got here. Best film editing went to Sound of Metal, and best visual effects went to Tenet, and when you consider how Hollywood basically pulled back most of their big VFX spectaculars, like, they just didn't release them this year. The category looks a little anemic, but it's important to remember that the Academy, once again, doesn't really like honoring just brainless VFX films. They like the visual effects category almost always goes to the nominee that would have been most likely to be nominated for Best Picture, even if it wasn't. And this one, Tenet. And a part of me is like, you know, we've been reversing cinema, like we've been reversing film for a long time. Part of me is a little like sort of underwhelmed by it, but it's done very well. Like it's certainly like an effective, you know, effectively presented. It's a cool looking film. Yeah. So those are the winners. The controversies are obvious. We've already mentioned a few of them, but there's a lot to celebrate here. There's a couple of films I really need to catch up on. I plan to catch up on all the nominees eventually, but obviously the winners I'm going to rush out to and try to get to this week or next. If you want to talk more about the Academy Awards, something specific you want to discuss, don't forget you can always email us letters@criticallyacclaimed.net, and we might read your email in upcoming We've Got Mail. But other than that, we're just gonna truck along and talk about some new releases. We got a couple of weeks worth of films to get to.
Do you want to do last week first or this week first?
Well, let's talk about the big one first.
What's the big one in your mind?
I think it's Mortal Kombat. It's number one at the box office and stuff.
Oh, I suppose so.
It's the one that like people are talking about. Yada yada yada.
All right. Well, Mortal Kombat is. I think it's maybe the fifth or sixth Mortal Kombat feature, if you count all of the animated ones that went straight to video.
There were two theatrical features, Mortal Kombat, and then there was Mortal Kombat Annihilation.
Yeah, those were live-action films in 95 and 97.
There was a straight-to-video Mortal Kombat animated thing, but it was, like, really just thrown together in the 90s. And then
There were a couple of TV series,
live-action and animated. And then there was recently an animated, I think it was called like Scorpion's Revenge or something like that, which I heard was quite good, but I didn't see that one. I have seen the two live action Mortal Kombats, and
And now you've seen the third as well. Yeah.
What's your history? What do you bring into Mortal Kombat? Did you play the game? Did you watch the movies?
I didn't play the game much. I remember when it came out. I remember what a controversy it was. The appeal of Mortal Kombat was its gore.
Mostly,
back in the 93 or whenever it came out. There was gore.
There were, like, at the time, like, semi-photorealistic characters, because they actually photographed people and animated those.
They photographed actors and used them to capture in sort of the sprites and had them fight each other. And there were
very novel
blood effects, and then things where you could like pull out people's skulls and the spine would still be attached.
Fatality system.
Called them fatalities. Yeah. And
game didn't even play that great, but Mortal Kombat 2 played really good. I liked Mortal Kombat 2.
Didn't play much beyond that, and I'm completely unfamiliar with the lore. Now,
it got complicated over the years. I lost track of it after Mortal Kombat 2.
The lore behind this most recent film, the 2021 Mortal Kombat feature film, is every so often there's a great tournament, a great fighting tournament between the realms. And there's two realms fighting in this tournament. There's Earth Realm, which is where we live, and the realm of like evil demons.
Outworld,
indeed. Yeah. And Outworld and Earthrealm are going to fight, so Earthrealm has to gather up its champions to fight the Outworld champions, who are all monstrous in some way.
And it's worth noting that the stakes are really high. Outworld has won the most recent 9 Mortal Kombats, and if they win one more tournament, then they get to take over Earth, which sounds to me like the plot of Space Jam. But doesn't it sound like Outworld came to Earth, and then Earth was just like, you cannot conquer us unless you, ten fighting tournaments in a row. There's no way they could possibly. Okay, 10 fighting tournaments in a row.
It's the premise is completely absurd. And in fact, it's really stupid. The fact that they're giving it a really sort of slick, serious treatment actually does the cheesiness of the story a bit of a disservice.
I think so.
Just roll with the silliness a little bit more.
I'm not a huge fan of the Paul Anderson version, like the original 90s version, which for a lot of people is still like the gold standard for video game movies, which I think is a little sad.
If that's the one, then
It's a fun PG-13 matinee action movie. I can't get too mad at it or anything like that, but there's only like 2 really good like kung fu fights in that movie, especially the one with Johnny Cage and Scorpion. Like, that one's aces. I got no complaints.
Dude, they fall into hell essentially, and they do their fight in
but
hell.
The fighters are actually doing a really good job. It's well choreographed. Like, that one works. And I think Goro was a fun like puppet. He's just a cool looking thing.
Not wholly convincing, but it didn't need to be. It was just nice to look at.
Yeah, but like, it's really thin. There's not a lot to it, really. Some of the dialogue and storyline elements are really laughable, but like, it's fun to watch. Mortal Kombat Annihilation is just I actually heard a rumor, I don't know how true this is, that it's literally a work print that they just said, screw it, it's fine.
It looks like it.
Yeah,
it
like they
really
didn't
cheap.
Even, like, all the CG looks unfinished because it was. And then the studio was like, it's fine, just release it. It's not that I think it could have been improved much. It's just a mess. It's like the worst kind of like video game like storytelling, where it's just basically like, here's a mechanic from the game and we're gonna explain it and make it sound like it's a big deal. You gotta find your animality, Liu Kang. And Liu Kang's like, isn't that stupid? Yes. It's really hard to watch that.
They fold in some of the video game lingo into this new one as well. There's a character named Kano, and he beats up this lizard monster and actually says out loud in dialogue, "Kano wins." like he's the announcer in the video game. No, later on, somebody says "flawless victory" out of nowhere because it's stupid.
I always find that really you have to really really earn that shit, and they just throw it in. But anyway, my point is the Paul Anderson film was light.
Yeah.
It was like, it probably could have stood to be like more violent, like more combat-y, but I think the overall tone of it was, this is going to be a little large because the game is a little large.
Mm.
In the new Mortal Kombat, everything is taken really seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Like
it starts with this tragic prologue where we get to see one of the characters' backstory from long ago.
And Sub-Zero kills Scorpion's family.
Yeah,
and
Sub-Zero is... like, he's a human-shaped fighter, but he's treated like this demon. Like, he's the most powerful being in the universe.
He's a ninja with ice powers.
Yeah, he has freezing powers, and he can just freeze your whole village just by thinking about it. He forms ice swords out of nothing, and they don't break.
It's cool. Except when they do. Like, there's this early bit where like, he's trying to kill a guy, and he makes it snow. And then he takes all the snow, and he turns it into ice daggers. Yeah. And then he throws it up against stuff, and it just collapses like snow. And I'm like... I know if the guy dies, the movie's over, but you couldn't come up with something better than just Sub-Zero decided not to be good today. Like
Sub-Zero made a fort. You know, it's... there's a prologue, and then we cut to Johnny Cage. No, he's not Johnny Cage?
Johnny Cage isn't in this movie.
I thought he changed his name to Johnny Cage at the end.
No, you got confused there. There was a poster for a Johnny Cage movie implying that Johnny Cage would show up in the next one.
Oh, I thought he was going to Hollywood and was going to change his name to Johnny Cage.
No, he was going to... I think he was supposed to be going to Hollywood to meet Johnny Cage.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I see where you got that from, but no. That's
okay, so the protagonist guy...
his name is Cole something.
Cole something.
A character I'm not super familiar with.
From
the video games, anyway. I know him from the movie, obviously.
He gets swept up with Kano and Sonya when the evil villains from another dimension come to Earth to kill all of Earth's champions.
Yeah. That's basically it. You know, basically, we don't actually get to the Mortal Kombat fighting tournament here. The idea is the fighting tournament is coming up, and Shang Tsung decides to ask all of his various monsters, like, hey...
He's the leader of the monsters.
Yeah, what if instead of fighting, what if we just killed them all before the fight, and then we win by default? The two greatest words in the English language, default. And everyone's like, cool, we can make a whole movie out of that, and then we can set up next one for the fighting tournament. So that's what they do.
So the good guys gather, they start to train, then they're interrupted, and that's the movie.
Pretty much.
That's it.
Yeah.
And then Sub-Zero and Scorpion reunite for the big climax.
I like...
Which has nothing to do with the characters we had been following.
No, not really.
There's like a bookend to this act.
The idea is that the character of Cole, played by Louis Tan, is a descendant of Scorpion. This is not a twist. It's right at the beginning of scene number two. He's a descendant of Scorpion, and he might be the one who was like prophesied to win Mortal Kombat or whatever. But beyond that, basically Scorpion and Sub-Zero. It's not even a spoiler. You see it in all the trailers. Like, they'll fight. And it's a pretty cool fight. Like, I got nothing against it. The thing that I can't get over about the whole Scorpion Sub-Zero thing here is at the beginning of the movie, Scorpion's with his family and his kids are there and his wife is gardening, and then when he has to like fight everyone off and he puts together his like signature weapon, the dagger on a chain that he can fling at you and then pull you closer to him.
Yeah, it's up his sleeve and
it's in the original movie they made it like a weird snake monster.
Yeah, he's a supernatural being in the original, and this one he's a guy who somehow comes back from hell.
Yeah, he brings the fires from hell with him, like kind of Ghost Rider style. But like,
but they explain that in like a line of dialogue. Yeah. This is not like his journey.
No. My favorite thing about this new movie is that dagger. We find out that dagger has an origin.
Mm.
It's a garden trowel.
Yep.
Scorpion's thing this whole time has been a garden trowel, and the history of this garden trowel is like kind of important. And if you had asked me at the beginning of the year, hey, which 2021 film is about the intergenerational history of a garden trowel? I would have assumed it was something by like Kelly Reichardt or like, you know, something kind of thoughtful and intimate. And then it's like, no, it's Mortal Kombat, dude. And I'm like, that's hilarious. Yeah, there's really not a lot to this movie. I like some of... I don't know how new any of these things are, and I hear the movie took some liberties with, like, the current Mortal Kombat mythology, which I just don't follow. I don't care about it.
Yeah, really. I'm not sure. I'm sure nothing too sacred is being violated.
I'm sure not, but I just don't know. There's a couple of things. Like, I did like that in the original Mortal Kombat movie, the human heroes had no supernatural powers. And I kind of like that once you're chosen for Mortal Kombat, you have supernatural powers, which I kind of thought was like, okay, that's fair. That way you have a real world, but you also get the heroes who can do the cool stuff you see in the video game. And I'm fine with that. I thought that was a pretty fair way to do it. Some of the powers that they get are stupid. Like, Jax. Jax is a fun character. He's, you know, he's a big, tough, cool guy, and everyone likes him, and he's got metal arms. And at the beginning of the movie, his arms are, like, ripped off. And then he gets, like, not very good cyborg arms. And there's a part in the movie, I was watching this with my wife and partner, Michelle, and there's part of the movie, I'm like, oh my god, what if Jax's, like, supernatural power is better robot arms? And then that's what happened. And I laughed my butt off. You're telling me that, like, the inner, like, awesome magic power within your soul was always going to manifest as robot arms? He had arms before yesterday. What was he going to do? Rip them off? Like, it just couldn't quite buy it. A lot of people are talking about that their favorite character in the film was Josh Lawson as Kano.
Who is clearly auditioning to play Wolverine.
Yeah. Not a fan. I think he's trying so hard to be this, like, and again, he's kind of a villain.
He plays this really abrasive character who doesn't want to go along with any of this. Yeah. He's ostensibly the voice of humanity and reason in this story.
Yeah, but he's also a killer and, like, a bad guy, and he's sexist, and, like...
And he gains super, he's scratched in the eye by a magical lizard monster, and...
That's how he gets a laser.
Yeah, and later on in the movie, we learn that the scratch... when he gets really angry, he gives him a laser eye.
Yeah, whatever. I'm not.
This movie is the stupidest shit. All right,
I'm not going to complain about that. My only problem with Kano is this: there's, like, villains or, like, anti-heroes you love to hate. I didn't love to hate him. I just hated him. I just didn't want to be around him. I found him annoying. My favorite character in this whole fucking movie was actually Cabal.
Was he the robot?
Yeah,
he's the guy in the robot mask.
There's a guy, we eventually see, like, Shang Tsung and his, like, minions, and one of them is a guy with hook swords. The actor is Daniel Nelson, but the physical actor is Daniel Nelson, but the voice actor is Damon Harriman. And that guy had the energy I wanted from Kano. That guy had the Han Solo energy. Where, like, you're watching this movie and everyone's, like, totally dead serious about it. And you now here's a guy who's totally immersed in the world, but also he's kind of over it. So he's just like, yeah, I'm fighting you. It's all a thing. And, like, that guy's about to get his soul sucked out of his body. It's a thing that happens. Like, I was with that guy. Like, Cabal made my day. Like, Cabal made me happy here. But, man, the rest of it's just... it's just as immature as the original film. But some of the fights are better, but not all of them. And it ended up being more laughable because it was trying to be so serious.
I do appreciate that they put in some fun gore this time. Like, this is R-rated. You get to see people beheaded and a pieces of Ricky their bodies get... people get their heads mashed. Somebody gets sawed in half. It's really wonderfully disgusting.
All in a way that could be edited down for television later.
Yeah, unfortunately, yes.
It's all very, like, a couple of distinct bits.
The CGI blood is particularly bad. CGI blood never looks good. It still doesn't here. But the whole idea of a Mortal Kombat... I mean, Mortal Kombat's taking all of its cues from movies like Enter the Dragon.
Enter the Dragon, Master of the Flying Guillotine.
Bloodsport, and any fight movie where fighters from all over the world come together. Some of them have a gimmick or a magic power. And they're going to fight in a ring, and whatever they win, they win.
It's such a great premise for a movie, and it amazes me how few fight movies actually do it.
Well, and it's such a simple thing that they just sort of lifted it to put into the game. It's like, okay, we're going to use this flimsy premise to put into our game just so we have an excuse to fight. So now we're going back, making a copy of a copy, putting that tournament idea back into the film. But the mythology in the games has become so elaborate that I feel like they don't feel comfortable just telling you that story any longer, or it's too simple, or maybe people would predict it if they just go with a simple fighting tournament. So we got something like this instead, where there isn't really a story. People just sort of gather and get together and fight. And if you're going to just do that, have some fun with it.
Yeah.
Make it brisk, make it light, make it gory fun.
I want the fights in the movie to be phenomenal. Yeah. And there's like two that are really good. And I know a lot of the people who are in the movie are actually like trained fighters. Like they got them specifically so that the fights would look good. But I ultimately just feel like the editing is too fast. Like it's just, you're not really showing off the fighting the way that you could. And I actually think like the best version of this movie is the first trailer they release, because they put all the best fight stuff in there. And then all like this sort of, all these sort of fight stuff is like, and it's fine, it's competent, but like, I don't want competent. Mm. I want the back of my head blown out by how amazing your kung fu is. I want, seriously, want to see the best. I think there's no excuse if you're making a Street Fighter movie or a Mortal Kombat movie.
Mm.
There is no excuse for this not to be the best martial arts films on the market. I will forgive everything else if the fight scenes are absolutely unbelievably amazing. And there's a couple of cool bits, but no. That's it. That's all I ask for. It's ultimately just a competent, Americanized action fight movie.
Yeah.
And that's not enough for me. And so ultimately, I don't hate this, but I also just didn't really like it. So I was, at first I was kind of just riding on mediocrity, but ultimately the more I think about it, the more I'm just not into it.
Yeah.
I
neither.
Yeah.
It's
I love kung fu movies.
If you're just going to do fights, do more, better fights and skip all of that exposition stuff. Cause this movie's like 110 minutes.
It doesn't need to be.
Get in and out in 80.
If it's going to be 110 minutes, but you better have better fights than this. Come on, man. Make them sing.
Pack them in there. Yeah. That's all.
Moving on. Let me talk about something that you saw last week.
Okay.
What did you see last week that you liked?
Well, let's see. Why don't we just go complete 180 and talk about the movie Hope.
Okie dokie doo.
Hope is a Norwegian film. It was submitted to the Academy by Norway for Best International Feature, but it wasn't nominated.
Only five.
And it is about a married couple. She's much younger than he is. He is... on his second marriage, she's on her first, and right around Christmas time, just as everything is getting really, really busy in their lives, and he has a big thing going on in his life, and she has big things going on in her life, she gets a cancer diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a very aggressive kind of cancer, and they say that experts in this kind of cancer are very rare. You're going to need an operation real, real soon, and the chances of you not getting cancer again, even after really good surgery, is really, really high. Yeah. So yeah, there's not a lot of hope here. And so this movie just sort of takes us through step by step, her emotional process in trying to cope with this idea that she's facing her own mortality, that maybe there is some hope here, but how tempting it is to not have any. And, of course, it's changing the relationship with all the people around her, and most notably her husband, who's played by Stellan Skarsgård, and how she starts accusing him of sort of changing her life for the worse, how she feels about her kids, how she might not have the most rosy view of her own kids given the circumstances, but also how they're really kind of the most important things in her life.
This sounds harrowing to me.
It's harrowing, and it just sort of... What I appreciate about Hope, though, is that it's not one of those, miserablest dramas where it's just going to focus on how horrible everything feels all the time. It's not about using coping mechanisms. It's not about the psychology. It's just about the process and about her story and her drama. And the acting is so good, and the frankness is so striking and welcome that it becomes a very engaging drama.
Hmm.
And it takes us through all of the highs and the lows, how some days are really, really good, how little tiny things can ruin a day. This is around Christmas time. She wants to have Christmas with her family because she knows right away, she just learned a few days ago, this might be her last Christmas.
Right.
And when she learns that, like weeks ago, her husband invited one of his work buddies to work to this Christmas party. this like throws everything out, you know, into perspective. It's like, no, this was going to be my last Christmas. We can't just have a buddy come by. Everything's ruined now.
Yeah.
And that, you know, starts weighing on her a lot. And of course, a part of this process is, of course, going to the hospitals, talking to the experts, and hearing time and time again, you don't have a very good chance here. Yeah. And her needing to come to terms with the fact that maybe she does. And at the end of the movie, we do realize that it's a very natural, very human instinct to continue to hope. Whether, you know, no matter how many times the experts tell you there's not much of a chance in this, she still needs to find her bliss in looking up. And I think that's the ultimate point of the movie. Whether or not, whether she lives or dies, whether or not she goes through the process or not, I'll leave for you to discover. But that she is able to find this emotional journey that ends up working for her is ultimately the ultimate point of it all.
This sounds like a movie that would absolutely annihilate me.
Yeah,
it really hits a lot of my bones.
It's really, it's really, really rough. Yeah,
yeah. This would just
the lead actress is really close to home. Andrea, I'm gonna murder this. Andrea Brayenhovig, Norwegian actress. I haven't seen her in anything before, but she is fantastic in this movie. And yeah, gives a lot of realism to this. Otherwise, I've seen cancer dramas before that are kind of hokey or a little bit melodramatic. This doesn't go for any of that, but nor, like I said, it's not really miserablest either. It just sort of gives us a very down-to-earth view of a lot of these things.
All right.
I really, really liked it.
Sounds good. Yeah. Again, sounds bleak, but sounds good to me. Let's see, what do we got? Okay, let me talk about the new film Together Together.
All right.
If you'll let me.
You may.
Okay, great.
I'll allow it. You
Thank
may.
You. This is a new film from writer-director Nicole Beckwith, and it stars Patty Harrison from the show Shrill, which I haven't seen. She plays a young woman who agrees to be the surrogate mother for Ed Helms.
Okay.
He doesn't have a wife or partner. He's middle-aged, and he really wants a child, and it doesn't look like that's likely to happen in the typical way. So he decides he's going to do this himself. And he ends up selecting Patty Harrison's character to be his surrogate. And this is an unusual situation. She isn't, like many surrogate mothers, at least that's according to the film, someone who is already in a relationship or is raising children of her own. She is young, and she is doing this for the money. She's trying to get a new start. And so is Ed Helms, in a way. And they find themselves thrust together repeatedly. And it's interesting because this is a very, very much a movie about friendship. It stays platonic, which I am incredibly grateful for. Not the least of which because the age differences would make it super creepy, but also because it would be really cliched and kind of obvious and feel like sort of a Chris Columbus 90s movie kind of thing. And it's not really about that.
Okay.
This is about two platonic people who are finding themselves getting closer together in a really intense emotional and, you know, it's physical. Her body is going through pregnancy relationship, but it's also transactional.
And that is
getting in the way. And that is something that ultimately potentially taints any connection they might have. Because when all is said and done, she's not going to stick around and raise this kid.
Yeah.
She's going to go. He's only paying her to do that.
I'm getting a lot of Juno flashbacks.
It would be a good double feature with Juno, I think. I think Juno is more affected in the terms of, like, it's like very particular comedic tone and it's very whimsical dialogue. Diablo Cody has a very particular dialogue pattern that she used in Juno. This is actually a lot more laconic than I was expecting. And I really like this version of Ed Helms. Ed Helms, I think, is a very funny actor who typically finds himself in very unfunny films. I think the broader it is, the worse it is for him. And that seeing him in something that's really grounded like this is actually really refreshing because I think he's really nailing it here. Patty Harrison is someone I really want to keep an eye on. I think she's absolutely stunning in this movie.
Nice.
I don't want to, it's such a simple movie. I don't want to reveal too much about it. I do think, though, that the ending is interesting, like the very ending. And I've talked to a couple different people about it. And some people took away something just incredibly positive from it. But for me, based on certain like blocking choices in the last shot followed by the credits, and I don't want to go into too much more detail than that, I actually thought that Nicole Beckwith ultimately kind of reframed the story a little bit from kind of like a charming but complicated friendship saga to something a little bit more cynical and biting. I thought that makes it really interesting.
I was going to say, in a good way or a bad way?
I think
way?
In a good okay. way. I think in a way that makes it really interesting and actually makes it more fascinating to me. And it made me like the movie more. I thought the movie was good, but maybe not remarkably so, other than the acting's really solid. But that ending and the way I interpreted it, and I haven't met a lot of people who have my interpretation of it, although I think it stands. My interpretation of that ending, I think, really brought it out. Okay. And I thought made it a lot more interesting than it initially was.
Okay.
But it is good. I do like this, and I do recommend this. I think that, if nothing else, Helms and Harrison are really, really wonderful together, and you should see them together, because that part's great.
Okay.
Yeah. That's all I got.
That sounds interesting, actually. Yeah. Like a laconic, cynical version of Juno.
Yeah, a little bit. Like, there's actually like an interesting scene in the movie where they talk about Woody Allen, and they talk about how those are stories about older men and younger women, and how every single one of those is basically this vampiric story about how older men are like leeching off of the youth and vitality of younger women, and how these characters don't want to do that, even though ironically, literally that's what's happening. He is asking her to carry a child to term and then give it to him and then leave. So I think it's interesting.
Which is the thing, surrogate parenthood.
Oh, it's
true. Yeah,
I don't mean to make that sound like a bad situation. Everyone agrees to it, and that should be healthy, and that should be fine. But like, my point is that it's exploring that, and I don't think it's entirely like cute and positive about it. I actually do think they understand that this is something that is, you know, not. It's not just a friendship, is it? There's something on top of that that will affect every single element of their interaction. So, all right, I think it's smart. I think it's interesting, and I really liked it. So, all right, moving on. What do you got next?
How about Monday?
Oh God, must we? What about Tuesday?
Aren't you cute?
I try.
Monday is a sort of a doomed romance film from a Greek director named Giris Papadimitropoulos. And it stars Sebastian Stan, who is sort of a layabout DJ living in Greece, and an American tourist played by Denise Goff. She's an Irish actress. And they...
is he playing a Greek character?
No, he's also American.
Okay, just saying.
And they're literally pushed together on a dance floor by a friend one evening saying, hey, you guys should make out. And lo, they start. And they end up getting very, very drunk on a Friday night. They wake up on the beach the next morning having, you know, experienced the throes of ecstasy. And she decides to not go back home at first, to stay in Greece for a few more days and see if she can continue, like, extend this fling a little bit and see how that makes her feel. And... as the, I feel like they have a lot of good physical chemistry. I feel like they they've captured something really, really exciting about first meeting somebody and first going into that, not necessarily romance. It's actually much more sexual than that, but that kind of sexual excitement and the excitement of starting up a relationship.
Yeah,
and
that initial connection. Yeah.
And the film explores how they try to turn that Friday night into forever, but of course, inevitably, hence the title, Monday comes, and they have to just start their real lives, and how difficult that is for them. He has a lot of layabout friends who are sort of keeping him from getting any kind of real job, or stopping the party when it needs to stop. Meanwhile, she's trying to go through the motions of settling down and figuring out what it means to settle down, because she really doesn't really have a definition of that yet. Things like she's really attached to a certain piece of furniture, a couch of hers. And when they can't move it into the apartment, she kind of starts to see this as a symbol of some kind of great failing in their relationship. And of course, you know early on that this thing is just doomed to fail, that their relationship isn't going to end very well. There's a little too much rising and falling action where we get to see them party, 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 and then fall back down again and sort of get back... back to real life and realize that they're really unhappy. And then they party again. And that happens three or four times throughout the course of the movie.
Right.
They could have cut maybe two of those cycles. It gets kind of repetitive after a while. It's a pretty long movie. But I did like it. I did like the excitement of the relationship and sort of this exploration of the notion of sort of like the vacation fling and if that can be translated into an actual relationship. I've seen that notion in sitcoms before. It was the plot of an episode of Emily's Reasons Why Not. Mm. If you recall the Heather Graham sitcom.
Oh, yeah. Like, she met a guy on vacation, and it was great. And it was basically even talked about how Stella got her groove back. Mm. And then she came home, and the dude came home with her. Mm. And it was, like, really awkward.
Yeah, you're supposed to be the vacation boyfriend. I'm not supposed to have you here.
We're supposed to have two nice days, and then bye.
Yeah, and this is about two people who actually, like, give it a real try, and this explores it in a much more adult fashion. And, I think there's some actual, like, good moments of adult emotional complexity where they realize just how incompatible they are.
I like how Sebastian Stan is evolving as an actor.
He's getting there. I like her a lot more. I think she gave, like, a really good performance in this. Sebastian Stan, Denise Goff again. Sebastian Stan is almost there as an actor. he was in the Marvel movies. He played the snowman and
the Winter Soldier.
I know it. I just don't care. And
it's fine. You can still get it right.
He plays a man with robot arm who is Captain America's ex boyfriend, and he doesn't have a lot to do in those movies.
TV series he did.
I didn't see the TV
series. The TV series, he had more to do. All right. He got to expand himself as a character.
Okay. My point is, he was in, like, five of these movies, and he didn't really have much to work with, because he's just one of, like, 1,000 characters.
Well, he was brainwashed for most of it.
So here he's, like, finally playing this sort of, like, hunky guy who's sort of empty on the inside, and I think that's at least a good character for him.
Yeah. Let's, okay, so you saw two more and I saw one more that were new, so why don't you take one more? What do you want to talk about next?
Let me talk about Jacob's Wife.
Please do.
Jacob's Wife, directed by Travis Stevens, is a vampire movie starring, get this, Barbara Crampton.
Yay!
Who horror fans know from films like From Beyond and The Reanimator, or just Reanimator. And Larry Fessenden, who is a big horror luminary who supports a lot of independent horror filmmakers and is a filmmaker in his own right.
Yeah.
They play a married couple. He's the local preacher. She is Jacob's wife. And their marriage is at an impasse. She is not really happy with him. Their marriage is very chaste. He's been sort of like giving her the stink eye over just decisions she makes to go out and have lunch with friends, because he's getting really, really jealous. And she feels kind of stymied by all this. She goes out to meet an old friend who flirts with her, and then they kiss in a warehouse, in a secret warehouse. And wouldn't you know it, a Nosferatu attacks her.
Ah!
Kills him, bites her, and she
sounds
starts
like a Sunday school
and,
story.
And she starts thirsting, doesn't she?
Yeah.
In more ways than one, you see. And and good golly. And, you know, of course, being the preacher's wife and also a vampire puts their relationship in a little bit more of a strain.
I would imagine it would.
And he does eventually find out that she's a vampire, but doesn't attack her. Just tries to figure out what this means for their marriage.
Mm.
Barbara Crampton is bloody amazing.
She always has been
amazing. Here she is just, you know, ripping heads off and taking her clothes off, just being the B-movie horror queen that she's always had a reputation as, but is now just sort of pouring so much more into it. She has so much energy and joy for this kind of material. It's just a pleasure to see her on screen again. Also acting opposite Larry Fessenden, who also has a passion for this kind of material. So they're taking this stuff kind of seriously. They're looking at it as a character piece.
Well, the metaphor is strong. It's you know, your marriage is on the rocks.
You are different people now.
And people have needs. Those needs might supersede the confines of the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
May also supersede the confines of your conventional morality. You know, it could be, I mean, I haven't seen the movie. It sounds really good. I wanted to, but could be seen as the idea of having an open relationship in your later years, for example, or swinging.
yeah, there
if
you
will. You know, like that's
all of that is in there. Yeah. And it's nice to see that. I think the two lead actors are the ones who are really giving this all of its life, because they are both genre veterans. Mm-hmm. They understand what this genre demands of them, but they're also not going to abandon all the important character work and the relationship that they're getting into.
Right.
So it's just a delight. If you're a horror fan, it's a delight. This is on Shudder. If you're on Shudder, you know what you're looking at. So it's really, really wonderful. The Nosferatu is played by an actress named Bonnie Ahrens, who played the nun in The Nun.
Oh!
Yeah. She has played a couple monsters. The nun showed up in, like, I think all of the Conjuring movies, didn't...
Yeah, I think it's implied in the first one, like a little bit, but yeah.
Conjuring 2, The Nun.
The Conjuring 2, role, then obviously The Nun.
The Nun.
And like the Annabelle movies, it wasn't important.
The Nun is awful, by the way.
The Nun sucks.
It's a terrible movie.
Yeah, good looking film. I like the aesthetic of The Nun, but like the movie itself is really, really bad.
Yeah, like it doesn't make any sense.
No,
and all this haunting stuff has no rules.
Yeah.
But
is this on Shudder? I'm not seeing it here.
It's produced by Shudder.
It'll be on there eventually.
It will be on Shudder.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Just wanted to clarify in case someone was like heading over. No, it sounds great. I really wanted to see it.
It's like when you back in the VHS days, you picked a horror film off and you saw it was produced by Fangoria magazine. It's like, okay, yeah, I'm in good hands.
Okay.
It might suck, but I know I'm going to get a lot of like interesting gore and fun monster stuff. This is a film that understands what a horror fan is looking for. And I can appreciate a certain matter of being pandered to.
All right, moving on. I saw the documentary Sisters with Transistors from director Lisa Rovner. This is a documentary about the history of electronic music, specifically through the female pioneers of the form, who have been largely apparently undiscussed, and yet were very much responsible for transforming electronic music into what we know of today. I didn't know a lot about electronic music going into this. I knew what I liked.
Uh-huh.
I knew John Carpenter had worked with electronic music a lot. I knew electronic music often makes you want to jump up and dance. But what I hadn't actually seriously considered, and what I love about this movie is the way that this movie frames the creation of electronic music as a unique creation of the 20th century, not just because of the technology, but because of what the technology could be used to express. And as computers and other various electronic technologies were used to create electronic sounds, the first inclination was not just to do normal music.
Yeah.
In fact, the first inclination was to do some very experimental and fascinating soundscapes. And some of the women who were interviewed in Sisters with Transistors, and actually there's almost no new footage in this. It's almost all archival.
Uh-huh.
A lot of it from like the 40s and the 50s. They're talking about how they would hear the technological world and they would hear within the technology that they heard the ways that in which electronics were communicating, but they didn't have a framework to express that until electronic music existed. Like, for example, women who were growing up in London during the Blitz and there were air raid sirens.
Okay.
That was a formative sound when they were growing up. An air raid siren.
Yeah.
So this electric squawk was something that actually had a lot of sonic depth to them. And like a lot of early electronic music was trying to elaborate on that or find within that something fascinating. And there's a lot of stuff in there that people will go like, oh, okay. Like there's talk about the creation of the original score for Forbidden Planet, which was the first film to have an entirely electronic score. There's a fascinating bit about a woman who turned electronic music into Bach. Like, we're going to do Bach, but with electronica, and how, on one hand, that brought electronic music into the mainstream and brought it a new level of appreciation. On the other hand, it was also kind of reductive about electronic music, because it basically said it's what we can do to do classical music different now, as opposed to its own thing. There's a really cool bit about how there was a lot of resistance to electronic music, and how this one woman who, oh God, I want to make sure I get her name right. Basically, she wanted to experiment a lot with various electronic forms of music, but there wasn't a lot of interest in something that was so new and so daring in, for example, film. Mm-hmm. However, commercials were always eager to be new and trendy.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
She ended up like doing tons of commercials, like so many commercials you wouldn't believe, with entirely different, like all the digital sound effects you would hear in commercials in like the 70s and 80s were from Susan Chiani, who would end up being the first woman to do an entire score for a theatrically released Hollywood motion picture by herself. Okay. When it was The Incredible Shrinking Woman.
Oh God, that's a terrible movie.
Yeah, well, I don't think anyone blamed her score for it. Oh, well, unfortunately, no. Probably because it tanked, it would be like another 10 years before there was another one. And I think it was Memoirs of an Invisible Man, but I'm not sure. Like, it was a while.
Okay.
So that's a fascinating bit of history, and it's really illuminating. Honestly, like that's all it can really be. This is a documentary that exists to illuminate.
Mm.
This is not a documentary that tells like a story with a distinct beginning, middle, and end. This isn't a story that is trying to make you ask serious questions. No, it's giving you the answers. Here is what we were missing. Here is the history of this medium, specifically through people who are often sidelined through history. And I thought it was really great. I highly recommend this documentary. I learned a lot. You know, it's not going to be like full of like tub thumping beats or whatever like that. If you're looking for like a music documentary, this is a documentary about sound. This is a documentary about soundscapes. This is a documentary about women on the cutting edge of art and technology, where they started to intersect in a brand new way.
Nice.
And that's really exciting. So I highly recommend it. I hope people check it out. And then our last new release is Honeydew.
Honeydew is also a horror film. This one is a lot more bizarre and stylized than something like Jacob's Wife. This is about a young couple. They're in their 20s. She's working on a college thesis about a mysterious fungus that has been lurking in the area.
So it's Among Us.
It's among this small community. It's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre setup. They go out into a rural area. There's some mysterious goings on to imply that the people who live out there might not be well, and it might be because of this fungus that has gotten into the wheat, which in turn has gotten into the cows, which in turn has gotten into the people and is affecting their brains.
Mm-hmm.
They come upon the cabin of a very kind old lady, who is maybe a little too kind, welcomes them in, offers them food. There's a weird dude there with big bandages all over his face and seems to be half mad and can only watch Popeye cartoons. Yeah, it's a cannibalism movie, and it turns out they're being primed for cannibalism, and there's a lot of really bizarre electronic music, but it's in this whimsical sort of way. It feels like a little bit more like Motel Hell.
That's
the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
If you haven't seen Motel Hell, do. It's really fun. it's a very like knowing, winking, cheesy, weird cannibalism movie with some really striking imagery in it. I like that movie a lot. Yeah. It's a modern Motel Hell.
Modern Motel Hell. It's a little silly, and it has a lot of really like completely sick, twisted stuff in it. And wouldn't you know it, Lena Dunham is in this movie in a role that might surprise you. And that's all I'm gonna say.
Well, in any case,
it might be a little predictable, but at least it has its weirdness and its style going for it. It sags a lot in the middle as people are just sort of wandering around this mysterious space looking for mysterious things, and we're just waiting for the secret to be revealed, which you've already figured out. But I think once it's revealed, it's gross and weird enough that if you're a sicko like me, then you can actually have a little bit of a good time with it. It's not great, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed how gross this movie
sometimes
was.
Sometimes personality is all it takes.
Yeah.
You know, this has been done before. Great. But I haven't told it before.
Yeah.
And I have a way of telling it. And hopefully that makes it worthwhile. And it sounds like it is. All right. Let's do our review roundup. We review our films that are critically acclaimed on the scale of C- to C+, where C is average, a little bit of good, a little bit of bad. Most movies are a C. C- is below average. Generally speaking, we don't care for it. Sometimes we even hate it, but it's basically anything that's not good.
Yeah.
And then C plus is above average.
Yep.
Anything above average, anything that's like genuinely recommended, might even be the greatest film of all time. Anything in that zone is a C plus.
Mm-hmm.
Whitney, on the scale of C minus to C plus, where do you put a Honeydew?
Honeydew is it's a C.
Okay.
Workable Tales from the Crypt kind of episode.
Okay. Yeah. Well done indeed. Sisters with Transistors, I'm going to give a C plus. Not like, you know, like, oh my God, it's the best movie ever made, C plus, but I was really valuable and I'm glad I learned something. And, that was a really interesting documentary. So I highly recommend that. Jacob's Wife.
C plus. I enjoyed Jacob's Wife.
I'm glad to hear it. Yeah. Let's see. Monday.
Monday. A C.
Okay.
See, it like I said, it does drag. It doesn't need to be as long as it was, but I appreciate some of the things it was getting at.
All right. Together, I'm giving a C plus. Again, not the highest recommended C plus I've ever given, but it's as a character piece, it's really good. The cast is very, very excellent. It's sharply written, and in the end I think it had a little bit more on its mind than I think even it was obvious at the get go. So, I think it's an excellent motion picture. I hope you check it out.
All right.
Hope,
C plus. Mm. Yeah, I really recommend this one. It's really raw. It feels really honest.
Mm. And then Mortal Kombat.
Mortal Kombat, a C minus. You don't need to see Mortal Kombat. It's slick. It's got good gore. Some okay fights.
Mm-hmm.
Not a good movie.
It's as
good as the 1995 film. I get, but it's not as fun as
that's,
that one.
That's what it boils down to. Yeah. I feel like it's just mediocre.
Mm.
And normally mediocre would be a C. That's kind of the definition of mediocre, but this is boring mediocre.
Yeah.
This is mediocre that's like, it's, you can't have a movie with like razor hats and dragon ladies and like head explosions. And at the end, maybe you go, eh. Like, I feel like you got to judge that on a curve a little bit. So I just think ultimately, I want to like it. I want to like this damn movie, but I feel like in the end, I just didn't care for it. So it's a very high C minus. It's not incompetent, but I just don't generally care for it. All right. So that's it for the new releases. Now we've got the critically acclaimed Streaming Club. We got two of these. The Streaming Club is where we, while we're mostly watching our movies at home on streaming services, we are also taking the opportunity to see what else is on the streaming services, older films that either Whitney or myself or both have never seen before.
That's right.
And these are decided via poll over at our Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. And we're a little behind on this, so we're going to do two this week. The first one is currently available on Amazon Prime. It is Steven Spielberg's The Terminal, which is not the movie most people think of when they think of Steven Spielberg.
Well, after, I think it was after Minority Report and Steven Spielberg started to make films that were a lot more overtly political, he sort of, you know, as he was maturing as a filmmaker, I think he became, a much more interesting filmmaker. But you could tell at around this time he started losing interest in sort of like the action adventure stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You look at it as like War of the Worlds, which he made immediately after The Terminal.
More of a downer, really.
Like he's not interested in sort of like the thrill any longer.
Even the last Indiana Jones he made felt a little disingenuous.
And Ready Player One and Tintin. I know you're a fan of Tintin, but
those
feel like more like demo reels. Like he's just playing with digital tools more than anything.
I look at it like Alfred Hitchcock making Rope. You know, where like he was an experiment. He tried it out. I think it was fun, but
I don't think they're fully successful. But but I think. Yeah, so when The Terminal was like right when he was starting to sort of change a lot as a filmmaker and become a little bit more of a lot more interested in things other than the action adventure that he would have been previously known for, like, you know, his Jurassic Parks. And The Terminal was it's sort of a riff on Jacques Tati in a lot of ways, especially Jacques Tati's Playtime. If you're familiar with that movie, it's a French film where the filmmaker Jacques Tati built an entire city so he could stage these gigantic, elaborate comedic set pieces where you can see things in windows and how it looks like people in various apartments are interacting with each other in little ways. And they're just these cute little moments of connection, but they make you laugh and they make you feel very pleasant. And for The Terminal, Spielberg built an airport. This is an airport terminal. The entire terminal is a set. And it stars Tom Hanks as a tourist from a fictional country called Krakoja. And when he lands it in this airport, which is in New York City, there has been a coup back in his home country, and it has ceased to exist. It was taken over by another power. Yeah, yeah. Well, so he lands, and he's essentially not a citizen of anywhere. Yeah.
His passport is invalid, and he's not let into the country because his passport is invalid, and he can't get back on the plane because his passport is invalid, and the only thing that they can do, and Stanley Tucci is in charge of the all these services at the airport, all Stanley Tucci can do is just say, you can stay in the airport, and that's all it even talks about. Like, you fell through a crack in the system. Like, this is a situation that was never considered when we were putting together this bureaucracy, and we don't know what to do with you, so all you have to do is stay here. And Tom Hanks, his character doesn't speak English very well, so he doesn't know what the hell's happening. All he knows is he's not allowed to leave the airport, and it takes him a while to figure out what his actual situation is. And the rest of the movie is this guy trying to live a life in an airport. He can't work because he doesn't live anywhere. He doesn't have a social security number. He doesn't have a place to sleep because there's no place to do that. He doesn't speak the language anyone else speaks, so he's incredibly isolated. This could be just an this could be a Michael Haneke film. This could be like an absolute nightmare of a horror film. Yeah.
It sounds like the setup for a Kafka story, but Spielberg is not interested in that. In fact, Spielberg, this was made in 2004, and Spielberg had already made his political film, which did connect to 9/11 when he made Munich, which was the year before this.
No, Munich was after this.
No, Munich was 2003, I'm pretty certain. Let me look that up.
I don't think that's true.
I'm gonna look this up right now
because I'm pretty sure Munich was a little later here.
I could have sworn Munich was.
Hold on, Munich. Yeah, Munich was 2005, the year after.
Oh well, I'll shut my mouth.
I think Minority Report had some vibes to it because it was about like sort of a police state.
Yeah. You know? But following 9/11, air travel was suddenly very stigmatized. If you look at movies that were shot take place in airports before 9/11, you'll see how flights, like air travel, used to be something very casual, incredibly lax. You could just, anybody could go in and out of the airport. You could meet someone at the gate to say hi. Security was, you just walk through the metal detector and your bag is on the x-ray, and that's kind of it.
Yeah.
And it became something very kind of frightening and very bureaucratic and very dry and incredibly dull for a lot of travelers. And I think what Steven Spielberg was doing here was kind of remystifying air travel, like turning it into some trying to say that there is some soul and spirit that can be found in air travel, like that in travel again.
Well, I thought was an interesting. Sorry, I didn't interrupt you. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, to quote Douglas Adams, he, at the beginning of one of his novels, he started it with, there is no phrase in any language equivalent to pretty as an airport. Because all airports are really ugly. He even said some of them are so ugly it can only be the result of a special effort. And what Spielberg is doing is taking this very sterile place. It's a very commercial place, too. It's all just, you know, commercial outlets and restaurants and Burger Kings and Barnes and Nobles.
There's this really hilarious moment where Stanley Tucci is looking down on Tom Hanks and he has nowhere to go. His country no longer exists. He's not allowed through the door to New York City. And he's looking at him through the window of a Borders.
Yeah.
A Borders bookstore, which is cute. It's a really cute image.
So what Spielberg is saying is not only is there humanity here, but you could conceivably live here. This could be a home.
No, I like the idea of an airport as society as microcosm.
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting, actually. The idea that it has its own sort of self-contained ecosystem full of commerce and culture. There's people who work there every single day. They spend the majority of their lives at work. Everyone else is coming to and fro, but there are people who spend every day at the airport working there. And they have connections. And a lot of great movies have been about taking workplaces and sort of examining them and looking at them as a sort of a makeshift family.
Mm-hmm.
Terminal is one of the few films to do that for airports. I've seen TV shows do it, like Wings.
Mm.
But Terminal does a really, really good job of it. And all while, and you brought up Kafka, and I think that's a really good thing. I was thinking about this, like, what if you tell a Kafka-esque story about the absolute prison that is complex bureaucracy, but you told it from the perspective of hope instead of hopelessness?
Right.
That's totally Spielberg's MO.
That persistence and good humor can carry you through that nightmare.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a really good framework for Spielberg to work.
Spielberg's a very optimistic filmmaker. He's,
It's kind of his raison d'etre, really.
Does he have any cynical movies?
Like, purely cynical?
Yeah, I haven't seen 1941. But
it's not. It's satirical, but I wouldn't call it cynical. It might be as close to Sixth Sample, though. I guess Jaws has a mean streak, but it ends pretty well. Close Encounters of the Third Kind ends with, like, a dad rejecting his family, but even Spielberg says he wouldn't end it that way. Now, Duel's pretty harsh, but even then, it's kind of got a happy ending. It's not his thing, but there's something very striking about this movie in that it is so tiny and intimate, and yet it needs to have this big scale in order to work. It needs to have the Spielbergian quality in order to understand the vastness of a situation. Because there's a play you can put at this. There's like a one act play, or this movie could have easily been made in a different way in like the early 1940s by like Preston Sturges or Ernst Lubitsch. And it would have had a very similar vibe. Lots of kooky characters wandering in and out, a character completely trapped in a bizarre situation. One person who, in this case, Stanley Tucci, who is like just so annoyed by the fact that they're slipping through the cracks, they're doing anything they can just to ruin them, just because it'll make them feel better. These are all the elements of a screwball comedy, and there are definitely screwball comedy bits in here, and they're well-earned, and they're very, very funny, but it's the genuineness here that really, really works for me. I remember thinking to myself, oh, Spielberg's making a light comedy? And no. Actually, Spielberg's making a very dense comedy, I think, with a lot of thought into it, a lot of really wonderful characters. Every single minor performance is really sweet.
It's really sweet, and there's a commentary for it all. There's the way workers are exploited, the way we take advantage of immigrants, and there is indeed several love stories interwoven throughout all of this that also reveal that genuine human connection can work its way through cynicism about love and relationships. Catherine Zeta-Jones plays a flight attendant who has been having an affair with a married man for a very long time. And Tom Hanks comes into her life and just by being kind makes her realize that you don't have to sort of pursue these cynical relationships on the side, on the down low. But you can do something a little bit more genuine than that.
And yet it ultimately doesn't feel like as twee as all that. There are actually characters in the movie who make decisions and sacrifices that hurt them. Then maybe they benefit other people, and those are noble sacrifices, but like it's not like everyone's going to like have a musical number at the end. There are people who are worse off in some respects because of this. And I like that the movie doesn't shy away from that. It's the kind of thing that Spielberg is often quick to do, is to, right at the end, because it seems like he's so affectionate towards the characters and the story, they just want to give him a mega happy ending.
Yeah.
And he doesn't quite do that. And I appreciate that. There are characters in this movie who do not get a mega happy ending. And I think that ultimately makes it feel, it's not real. It's arch. It's definitely kind of like a modern fairy tale kind of thing. But I don't know. I think he gets away with it. I actually, this is one of the better, I think this might be one of the better Steven Spielberg movies that no one talks about, of which there are quite a few.
Yeah.
Like, when was the last time you heard anyone talk about, like, Always? You know? But, like, I think this is one that actually, like, really deserves to be rediscovered here. I think it was largely written off at the time as Spielberg's just gotta try something and we're just gonna sort of wave it off. But, like, I actually think this is one of the more interesting films in his filmography, just in terms of, like, how it stands kind of differently from all of his other films. And yet, I think if any other filmmaker had done it, it would have come out completely different. And I'm glad it exists. I really like this movie a lot. I'm going to recommend this movie to anyone who'll listen.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw this when it came out. I saw it in theaters. And I remembered being charmed by it. I thought there were some interesting elements. I liked the mechanics of it more than anything at the time, because he did construct this entire airport, and he gave a
lot of... Which sounds like hubris, but imagine shutting down JFK Airport, which is where it takes place, to shoot the movie. People would wreck the world. Like, that's a big hub of transportation.
So I remember just the way he constructed all of it and the way he started, you know, moving the camera around this space, and we got a good sense of all of that and the mechanics of what it would be like to live in an airport and how you can construct a bed out of those awful airport chairs. You know, little details like that I thought were really interesting. How do you get a job in an airport? How do you apply for a job when your address is that terminal where I'm sleeping?
Yeah, exactly.
I thought all of that was very charming, but it wasn't until I got to rewatch it that I realized how much Spielberg is really getting at in this movie. And I appreciated it a lot more and walked away just completely dazzled this time about not just the mechanics, but all of the humanity and what he was saying and why it was important to have this type of hope right at that time in history.
Especially at that time in history, but like, and it's also something that I think is kind of universal, the idea that we are completely at the whim of the paperwork that has been written about us, or that we can fill out. And if that paperwork is not filled out in triplicate, or if the system in which we arrive has not prepared for the situation we present to it, there's nothing for us.
Yeah.
And that's really, really scary. And I think it's scary in this movie, too. But I think in the end, this movie does have the ultimate point that perseverance and good humor, as you said, matter. I would love to see this as a double feature with The Martian. Now that's a work of criticism, because I think a lot of people appreciate The Martian for doing a lot of the things that happen in The Terminal. Yeah, and well, if you show The Martian and then you show The Terminal, I think people are going to see what's really going on here.
The idea that good humor and kindness are a vital human survival traits is something that runs through both of these movies.
Yeah. And then the other film that we had on this week's Critical Game Streaming Club is a movie that is on Netflix. It's only on Netflix for a couple more days, so we really had to get to this one quick. We did not think that through.
We didn't think it would go away.
Yeah, which of course they do, which is one of the frustrating things about streaming services. It's the 1970s horror film The Car. Which is about a car.
It's about a Lincoln Continental that looks evil.
Yeah, they gave it
like angry eyes.
Yeah, and they like squash the top a bit so it like looks a little bit meaner and
And it's talking about a small town running people over. Who's driving it? Is anyone driving it? Is it a haunted car? What is it doing? Who knows? But it's stalking around. It's a stalker slasher movie, but the stalker slasher is a living car.
Yeah.
It's a 70s investigation movie. James Brolin plays the local cop. Ronnie Cox from RoboCop and Star Trek The Next Generation plays one of the deputies.
And he was already kind of a big actor at the time, so I was a little surprised to see him in, like, the third lead.
Yeah, it's like a supporting role.
Yeah, I mean, not that he was, like, always, like, the star, but he was usually, like, the second lead, I think, by this point. And so it's a small town, and they are besieged by a killer car. The car is running people off the road, like, on large bridges over a cliff. The car is running over people repeatedly while other people see it. Like, the car isn't trying not to be noticed, which is, I think, always fun. And then gradually the car gets more and more ambitious and tries to, like, kill 100 kids who are, like, practicing a parade.
Yeah, like, breaks onto, like, a school campus and starts tries to drive over people.
And then the kids all run to, like, a nearby cemetery, and the car can't get into the cemetery. So instead it, like, growls like at the foot of the cemetery and like and it, does donuts in the parking lot,
and it pisses off the humans so much that they start yelling at it and cussing at it and calling it names. That's not wise to do with this car.
I would if someone's trying to kill me, even if they're whether or not they're a magical car, my first thought probably won't be to try to emasculate them. Like, let's just see how far we can push them today.
You rile them up and they make a mistake. But
I know, I'm just saying, it's a Hail Mary move. It's a Hail Mary.
That leads to a wonderful scene later on. It's the single static shot of the woman who was insulting the car on the telephone at night, talking to James Brolin.
Yeah. And she's led by Kathleen Lloyd.
Kathleen Lloyd is the actress. And we can see out the window, like, while she's on the telephone, we see this, like, night shot out the window behind her. Mm. And it's out of focus. And we see a light appear in the window. And she's just on the phone. There's no sound. And we see the light get closer and closer. The car is about to charge the house. It's great.
You loved this.
I did like this.
I'm surprised. I kind of like this movie. Yeah. I never really. This is the second time I've seen it.
Yeah. Well,
I like it. I'm surprised that you. What makes you really get into this movie so much?
Well, I've seen a lot of car chases in my day, and usually they're staged in sort of an action scenario. Now, car chases, if you think about it, don't really make a lot of sense. Because what happens when you catch up to the other car? You're still both in cars. You have to stop and get out of the car to get the other driver.
Right.
Or crash into them, and that's just a car crash.
Well, you're just trying to prevent them from getting away. So basically, you're following them until they run out of gas, or they have to stop, or you can run them off the road, or something. But the point is to get them out of the car. You're right.
Oh, yeah. So you're chasing them in a car. You have to wait until the car stops. That's the end of a car chase. And then there's, like, car wrecks and, you know, motorcycles slam into you. You know, the action scenes have gotten a lot more elaborate. But there's always an inherent logic to them. It's just destruction for the sake of it. That's why you put it in an action movie. You want to see destruction. You want to see a car get smashed. I see a lot of cars. I wish I could smash those cars. Here's an action film that lets you sort of have that outlet.
When next time someone does a Street Fighter movie, please keep in the mini game where they have to beat up a car.
Yeah, that just was the smashing best. Up a car.
Yeah.
The Car is a horror movie about a car crash.
Mm-hmm.
But because there's no driver... It's just an autonomous car. You can have all of those car crashes for the sake of itself, for the sake of its own violence. You get to see that all of this vehicular destruction is actually supposed to be kind of horrific. A car is a monster. Mm. It's this big, scary, growling thing that causes explosions. You turn a car upside down, it explodes. I learned that from movies. And indeed, there's a scene in this movie where the car pushes another car off of a cliff, and it tips over right at the edge of the cliff, turns upside down, and it explodes immediately.
Yeah.
It doesn't even hit the ground yet. It just explodes in midair.
Listen, it's like Here Comes Mr. Jordan. The car was like, listen, I'm going to die when I hit the bottom of the cliff anyway. I might as well blow up now and have some fun with it. Boom.
The car just decides to blow up.
Well, if it's an option. Cars can do anything they want.
I think it repurposes a lot of the language of action car chase cinema into horror, and I find that incredibly appealing. Indeed, it allows, because the car is supernatural, it also allows for some pretty spectacular car stunts.
I wish
there's
was
a scene where two sheriff cars are charging at the evil car, and it does a sideways fucking cartwheel into the cop cars. Like, well, fine.
I mean, that was a good one. I'll give you that one. That's my thing with this movie. I feel like this movie is a lot of promise and an only okay delivery. I love the premise. The premise, I mean, the way the movie frames it, it's basically Jaws. It's there's a small town. People are getting killed by a car. And at first, the authorities are like, well, that sucks. We should do something about that. And then people just keep getting killed by the car. And then it's a matter of what can we do about it? Mm. We can put up roadblocks, but it's not leaving the town. So it doesn't really fucking matter. No one gets the make isn't specific. It doesn't have a license plate. So this is why I thought it was an interesting double feature with the terminal, because it's kind of about the failure of bureaucracy to save this town. We're like, oh, there's a car killing people. Great. Do we have any training for that? None. What the fuck do we have cops for? Mm. And there you go. But yeah, I feel like the actual car stuff in this movie ranges from occasionally really cool, and you've kind of listed the good bits, to fine. And that's the thing. I feel like this
it's a 70s movie, so there are bits where there's just human interaction that are a little
slow. I don't mind the human interaction. I actually think they actually did a pretty good job of giving all of the minor characters in this movie enough personality that they feel real.
Mm.
I always appreciate that. I think that's a super important thing no matter what you're writing. Any small character, I don't care if they have only one line, you get it. Like there's a character who comes in, like the sheriff... You know, the lead sheriff dies, he gets killed by the car, and then James Brolin has to take over. And the sheriff dies, and the coroner shows up, or the guy who runs the morgue, and he's just like, the guy had no next of kin, I need you to sign this stuff. And James Brolin's like, oh, okay. Hey, listen, we'll take up a collection to pay for all the expenses. And the Morgue guy's like, I knew him. You don't have to. And I'm like, there you go. He had a relationship. He existed within this town. Yeah. He doesn't just serve a function. He had a connection. And that gave the actor a little something to play. Like, he's actually mourning this person. Yeah. That character is three lines. And they're a real character. And I really like that.
And there's a scene early on where there's a guy sitting by the side of the road hitchhiking, and he's playing French horn. He has a conversation with another character.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a big part in the plot, but he has a lot of personality.
Yeah.
There's this horrendous, like, abusive husband character who is witness to a lot of the car stuff, so he thinks he might be crazy for a little bit, and there's this, like, dark Tales from the Crypt element to it. And... Yeah, I hate the character. He's an abusive asshole, but everybody around him knows about him and has a relationship with him.
And there are people who are trying to get him. And, I appreciate that.
So yeah, there's a lot of these interpersonal dynamics that are really good.
Yeah, so the character stuff I was fine with. The stuff for me that fell a little short is just the car stuff. Oh. And I feel like, you know, if this movie had been made, and this is going to sound like a cliche, but let's just be frank here. This movie had been made in Australia, it would have been so much cooler. Like, the car movies that were coming out of Australia around this time. This is, like, a little bit before Mad Max, like, but...
Road Games, that kind of stuff.
Stunt Rock. Like, there's all kinds of, like, really cool car movies that were being made that were just really death-defying, daring, stunt-filled, action-packed car movies that were shot in this really exciting way. And I think there's the occasional awesome shot in this movie, but I don't really get that sense of acceleration. I don't really get that sense of power, of, like, the grinding of the gears, you know, that I feel like really could have made this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still fine. It's a good watch. I like it. But, like, I feel like it could have made it amazing with just a little bit more zazz. this movie was directed by a director.
Elliot Silverstein is his name.
Elliot Silverstein, who had an interesting career. He directed Cat Ballou, which is, you know, Academy Award winner, won Lee Marvin his Oscar for Best Actor. He directed the Western A Man Called Horse. He directed several Tales from the Crypt episodes, including The Reluctant Vampire, which I always liked.
It's the one with Malcolm McDowell as a vampire who works at a blood bank.
Yeah, it's really, really sweet, actually.
And how George Wendt figures out that he's a vampire.
He also did several episodes of The Twilight Zone, and he's a good director, a lot of varied material here. I think that's all really, really solid. I think this is just for me, this is like a 3-star movie. This is like above average. Like, this is a concept that could have just been terrible. And I think they filmed it rather well. It's a little derivative, but it's pretty good. But I don't think it's as good as this movie can get. Okay. And so that's what it boils down to for me, is I just feel like this is a solid movie, but there are maybe more exciting ways to do this. And I would kind of be interested in seeing this being done again. There were a couple of other movies that were very similar to this. The Wraith. The Wraith with Charlie Sheen, which is
bad.
Really bad.
It's quite bad.
It's entertainingly bad. Like, it's weirdly bad.
Yeah.
And I was actually having this conversation with my wife and partner, and I was like, who do you think would win in a fight, the car or the Wraith? And she was just like,
the car would win.
No, the question was, where is the fighting take place, and who has prep time? That's always the question. Who has prep time? Does the car have prep time?
First of all, the car is a car. What's it going to prepare? Doesn't have hands.
It can prepare anything it wants. It's a magical car,
I suppose.
One thing I do think is interesting is that they never even try to explain the origin of the car.
Nope.
The car is supernatural and it hates, and that's it. It wasn't wronged. It isn't, like, possessed by a serial killer. It's not, like, did a satanic rite in, like, a body shop or nothing. Like, nothing. Never explained. It's just a supernatural car. And you would think that that would make it feel like something's missing, but it actually doesn't. It actually is fine. I actually was totally cool with that. Anyway, The Car. It's on Netflix. Check it out while you can. I'm sure it will continue to be available in some form in various other streaming services and home videos. So if you're super interested in it, please check it out. Next time on the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club, we're going to be talking about movies on Shudder that are on Shudder and are movies. Shudder is the horror
movie streaming service.
Yeah, it's dedicated almost exclusively to the horror genre or things that are horror adjacent. Whitney has chosen on the streaming service of Shudder the films Black Sabbath, Which is a horror anthology film from the great Mario Bava. And what was the other one?
The Devils.
The Devils.
I have not seen The Devils.
Which is also leaving the service pretty quick. So if you want to follow along with The Devils, if that wins the poll, over on patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, every tier can vote for the polls. Even if you're $1 a month, you get to vote for future episodes. The Devils, which is a classic Ken Russell film, and Black Sabbath, and the films that I have picked are Bay of Blood, which is considered one of the prototypical slasher movies. It's arguably the biggest hole in my horror movie education. And also a more recent horror film that I've heard amazing things about, and I keep looking for an excuse to get around to it, Lake Mungo, which I know a lot of people think is one of the better horror films of the last 20 years. So I've heard
nothing but positive things about Lake Mungo.
Same here, but I've never got around to it, and always looking for an excuse. So one of those films will win the critically acclaimed Streaming Club poll. And to vote on it, go to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Thank you to all of our patrons, without whom this show and any of our other shows would not be able to exist. Thank you. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Thank you. You're amazing. If you want to contribute to the show, that's the best way to do it. If you can't afford to do that, follow us on Twitter. We're at Critic Acclaim. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
Be sure to subscribe wherever you subscribe to your podcasts. Leave us a review wherever you find us. That really helps a lot. We cannot accentuate that enough. Like, that really helps us find more audience. And of course, we would love to hear from you. You can either tweet us at our various tweets, at Critic Acclaim, at William Bibbiani, at Whitney Seibold. Or you can email us, letters@criticallyacclaimed.net is our email address. We might read your email and respond to it on an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. And of course, we got soap over at Etsy. Go to Etsy and look for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. We have a lot of new soap designs, and first Saturday of the month, we drop a whole lot of new soap designs. And we got some really cool stuff coming up for May, but a lot of the stuff from April is still available. So please check it out, and thank you to everybody who has already purchased some. And look for some reviews. The reviews are really awesome so far. We're really grateful for you. So that is it for this week, I think.
That's it.
Cool. Never forget, everyone's a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?